WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.
News now.
WMAL News at 7. Good morning, I'm Heather Curtis. A man facing charges in connection with the murder of his girlfriend's sister in front of that woman's baby in July is arrested after police spent hours trying to find him. The Loudoun County Sheriff's Office says 25-year-old Stone Colburn was arrested late last night by police in Chatham County, Georgia. The Sheriff's Office released Colburn from the Loudoun County Adult Detention Center on Thursday after it says his original charges for murder were dismissed by the Office of the Commonwealth's Attorney, Buddha Bibarai. She's blasting the Sheriff's Office, saying Colburn was erroneously released, even though her office filed an additional charge against Colburn for concealment of a dead body. He's accused of putting his girlfriend's sister's body in a garbage can and wheeling it to the end of the driveway. Maryland's Republican gubernatorial candidate Dan Cox says he disagrees with a court decision allowing election officials to start counting mail-in ballots before Election Day. He filed an appeal of a lower court's ruling that local boards of elections do not have to wait until 2 days after the election to start counting mail-in ballots. That was state law. A lower court judge said with mail-in ballots now very popular, boards of elections would not be able to verify the vote count within 10 days of the general election as required if they had to wait to count those ballots. Maryland's highest court accepted that decision and reaffirmed it. Cox says in a statement to WMAL, now it's up to each of the local jurisdictions to do the right thing and count mail-in votes according to the laws of Maryland. Comments are pouring into an online public forum for and against the Youngkin administration's new transgender policy for schools.
Under the new rules, parents would have to notify school officials of any change in their child's gender, name, or pronouns. One anonymous poster writes the policy would be so detrimental to the well-being of many children. Another says this allows parents to protect their children, adding it shouldn't even be necessary. Teachers and schools should stick to teaching their subjects, not political activism. Governor Glenn Youngkin has said all school systems must comply, but some, including Alexandria City Schools, have signaled they will not. Rachel Sutherland on WMAL and WMAL.com.
In response to the Youngkin administration's policy, the Fairfax County School Board voted unanimously this week to make October LGBTQIA plus History Month. Russian authorities say a truck bomb has damaged a bridge between occupied Crimea and Russia.
Social media posts showing a fire so hot and so big it caused a section of the bridge between the Russian mainland and Crimea to collapse. Russia's National Anti-Terrorism Committee said a truck bomb ignited seven railway cars carrying fuel. Reuters reports an advisor to Ukrainian President Zelensky calls the Crimea Bridge explosion the beginning, and everything illegal must be destroyed. The region holds symbolic value for Russia and is crucial for sustaining its military operations. Vladimir Putin's already ordered an investigation into the cause. Jill Nato, Fox News.
Traffic and weather next on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Traffic and weather on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Good morning. On the Virginia side of the Beltway, I just checked out the cameras. I didn't see any crashes. There isn't any construction being set up yet. You'll be at the posted speed limit on the inner loop and on the outer loop. Not the 66 in Fairfax County. You're not hitting the brakes on the eastbound side or even on the westbound side. A 95 in Virginia between the Beltway and Fredericksburg. Lanes are clear both northbound and southbound. And in D.C. on 295, 395, and 695, I don't have any reports of any slowdowns there. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Brisk start to the morning and through the afternoon. Sunshine will help take temperatures up a bit, but still below average in the low 60s. Overnight 40s and 30s, some frost once again a possibility off to the west. Mid-60s for highs on Sunday. Early next week, temperatures making a run at near 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraaff in the First Alert Weather Center.
49 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday morning update.
It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler, and John Gizzi joins us every week, starting off hour two. He is the White House correspondent and chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. John, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
We've been talking a lot about Senate races, but it looks like we got an open seat in a state that we hadn't expected to have an open seat this year.
On Thursday night, the word was out that Ben Sasse, Republican senator from Nebraska, was poised to resign his office and become president of the University of Florida. He is the former president of a small Lutheran college in his native Nebraska and has a long background in academia. What most Republicans and many Democrats remember is that he was one of the seven Republican senators who voted to convict Donald Trump in his second impeachment trial. Now, this caused controversy back home. Other Republican office holders shunned him, and several Republican county committees censured Senator Sasse. There was question whether he could survive a Republican primary or not. In any event, he took the option that was available to him and has decided to leave. Governor Pete Ricketts, of course, could appoint any Republican to the seat, and in the historically Republican Cornhusker state, that seat is likely to stay Republican.
So, John, for that seat, what happens next?
Once an appointment is made and a new senator takes office, Nebraska will gear up for a special election in 2024 to finish the remaining 2 years of Senator Sasse's term.
Well, let's look at some of those hotly contested races going on for the U.S. Senate around the country. The momentum seems to swing back and forth. And what is the latest in Colorado?
Well, this is a state that the punditocracy was pretty much ignoring until lately, when polls show Republican challenger Joe O'Dea within 10 percentage points of the Democratic incumbent Michael Bennett. Now, it should be pointed out that even though Colorado went for Joe Biden in 2020 and for Hillary Clinton in 2016, races for other offices are very, very close. Senator Bennett was appointed to a vacancy in 2009. A year later, he barely squeaked through to win a special election. And in 2016, he won a much closer than expected re-election over a candidate considered not exactly in the top tier. Now he faces Joe O'Dea, an orphan adopted by a police officer in Denver, someone who went on to start a multi-million dollar construction business that he now runs with family members. He's a conservative Republican on fiscal issues. He knows how to read a balance sheet, and he's pro-life, although he opposed the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade and putting abortion under the aegis of the states. Mr. O'Dea is conservative on most other issues. He did say that he would have voted for the president's infrastructure bill and that he hopes Donald Trump does not run. Oh, yes, he says Joe Biden won the last election. Former President George W. Bush, who rarely makes campaign appearances anymore, is going into the Centennial State to stump for Mr. O'Dea. Other Republicans think that he's just moved away from what is now the Republican mainstream, that he's trying to be a Democrat and won't win. We'll see about this race.
Pennsylvania's Senate race took an interesting turn this week. Accusations that Dr. Oz was responsible for the deaths of 300 puppies in a medical experiment, and the revelations by the Associated Press that John Fetterman had a little trouble showing up for work as the lieutenant governor.
Well, yes, they're coming at both candidates with both barrels, it seems. It's funny. So many Republicans come under fire for being mean to their dogs, going back to Mitt Romney supposedly having his ride on the rooftop of his car. Now it's someone who allowed 300 dogs to die. I guess we'll never know the full story on Dr. Oz and the pooches, but one thing stands out. This is someone who won a Republican primary by 800 votes, the second closest primary in the history of the Keystone State. Now, the latest polls show that he's closing in on Democrat Fetterman. And, in fact, in the latest survey, 46 to 40% of the vote. John Fetterman, meanwhile, suffered a stroke just before the primary. It turned out to be a lot more serious than he let on. Now, his statements, everything from his views of wanting abortion under any circumstances to scrapping Pennsylvania's very lucrative fracking business, are being waged against him. And it turns out that he was absentee from the office of lieutenant governor quite a bit while seeking the higher office of U.S. senator. This is a race that's probably going to go down to the wire, and it will only have one debate October 25th. He thinks it will have major ratings that evening.
In Georgia, as if Herschel Walker didn't have enough problems before this week, he has another big one come out.
He certainly did. It turned out that charges were leveled against him by the Daily Beast publication that he paid for the abortion of a woman he had briefly dated. Now, this woman produced a get-well card from him and a $700 check. The one-time University of Georgia football great appeared before reporters and denied all the charges, announced a lawsuit against the Daily Beast, and said he never paid for an abortion for anyone. This is someone who's running as a strong pro-life candidate, opposed to abortion under any circumstances. Now the questions start. Can he survive an onslaught like this? Well, National Republicans are rallying to him. Senator Scott, the chairman of the National Republican Senate Committee, said, "We're standing with Herschel." Pro-life groups, such as the Susan B. Anthony List, are also rallying to the embattled candidate. Interestingly, his Democratic opponent, Senator Raphael Warnock, says next to nothing about the controversy. That's because he has questions about violence against his former wife, as well as delinquency in child support. Politics are getting very, very dirty in Georgia.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. John, thank you so much.
Rick, always a pleasure, and indeed, these are exciting times.
It is a Saturday morning update. It is 7:17. Cheryl Atkinson is coming up next. We'll talk to KT McFarland and Tony Schaefer between now and 8 o'clock. But first, Albie Dees in the WML Traffic Center this morning.
So far, so good in Maryland, in Prince George's County, and in Montgomery County. I looked at the cameras around the Beltway. No crashes or construction is slowing you down. You'll be at the posted speed limit. Now in Montgomery County on 270, no delays being reported between the Beltway and Frederick, both northbound and southbound. In Prince George's County, if you're traveling between the two beltways, either on the BW Parkway or 95, you're not tapping the brakes northbound or southbound. Route 50 in Prince George's County between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, that's clear and at speed. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Brisk start to the morning and through the afternoon. Sunshine will help take temperatures up a bit, but still below average in the low 60s. Overnight 40s and 30s, some frost once again a possibility off to the west, mid-60s for highs on Sunday. Early next week, temperatures making a run at near 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraff in the First Alert Weather Center.
47 degrees now in the nation's capital, 7:18, the Saturday morning update.
Monday, we'll talk to Joe DiGenova about the latest Hunter Biden drama. Plus, we'll celebrate Christopher Columbus because it's Columbus Day. O'Connor and Company, 5 to 9 a.m. on WMAL.
It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by Cheryl Atkinson, investigative journalist, host of Full Measure, tomorrow morning, ABC 7 at 10 o'clock. Cheryl, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
We heard so much about the refugees coming out of Ukraine at the beginning of the war and the flood into Poland and across Europe, but we haven't heard that much recently. But you were recently in Berlin, so tell us what the story is on those refugees coming out of the Ukrainian war.
I don't think this story has really gotten the attention that it deserves. This is the biggest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. And it's continuing. It hasn't slowed down. This is millions and millions of people leaving Ukraine for Europe. A lot of them ending up in Germany. And I spoke with a German official in the last couple of days who said they really don't know what they're going to do with all the people because they have now run out of capacity when it comes to housing. And it's not just Ukraine, by the way. They're getting a flood of refugees coming in also from war-torn Muslim countries like Afghanistan and Syria. And what I did was I went to the main intake center in Berlin where so many of them have come through, the Ukrainians. This one was set up especially for this crisis. And I speak with the relief workers who are in charge of trying to sort through this mess, and also I spoke with some of the Ukrainian refugees.
How would you put this in context with the other global emigrations going on around the world?
Well, every time I visit Europe and do something on the people who are being trafficked across the water into Greece from Middle Eastern places and from Africa, and Greece trying to deal with thousands and thousands of people that it just can't take in. And I look at, you know, many Muslims who have come into other countries like Denmark and created a culture clash as the countries want to absorb them and want to help, but then end up in a crisis of sort of their own. There is a global migration going on, and I'm sure there's to some extent always been migration, but right now you see in so many places people are leaving what they consider less desirable countries and parts of the world and fleeing for the countries that they consider to be more desirable, which happen to typically be in Europe and in the United States. And this is going to reshape things in a big way beyond how they've been for really the past decades that we've been alive in our time. This is a big reshaping.
We see the impact of the global energy crisis. Of course, OPEC cutting back on production of petroleum. But when you look at other minerals and other materials, there's one that you've got a story on tomorrow that we may not be particularly familiar with.
Well, it's true. It's cobalt. And cobalt is something I didn't know much about, but it's apparently very necessary in the making of batteries. We've heard about lithium, but cobalt's very necessary, too. And as we need more and more batteries, including electric car batteries, we're short on supply on some of these minerals like cobalt. And guess who's dominating, like it seems like so many other things? China. So here we are in the United States relying once again on China for something that we need for our smartphones and our electric cars and all the things that we have today. So Sunday on Full Measure, Scott Thuman is taking us to a mine in Idaho where they're digging deep for cobalt supplies to try to become a major supplier of what we need here in hopes of making us less reliant on China. But this brings up a big problem, you know, something that really could impact national security. And then another complication, we've talked about this before, you know, the search for green energy and clean energy, turns out a lot of the processes involved are dirty for the environment. And mining, likewise, can be a big problem. So they're grappling with potentially toxic impact on the environment of mining. We're much more careful here when we mine. There are more rules and regulations about the environment than in places like China, which we're patronizing now to get these things. So that's just another piece of the puzzle, and we'll be talking about that Sunday on Full Measure.
We've seen some pretty significant blunders when it comes to polling and incorrect projections, races coming out the exact opposite of what was expected. And there's been a lot of questions about the process of polling, but you've got a story tomorrow that, I guess, kind of a unique angle on all this.
Yeah, you know, I've covered since the mess in the 2016 time frame of so many polls that were so wrong, and I've also covered how polls, I think, have come to be used by propagandists and corporate and political propagandists to influence public opinion rather than measure it, and thus they become somewhat unreliable, as we've seen. So what is the answer? People still are interested in polls, and they'd like to have polls that they could kind of rely on. And so there's this new idea that's being worked on, and I interview someone who's kind of at the forefront of this, to use artificial intelligence and probably the world's biggest database for polling instead of the traditional samples. A lot of the polls that we talk about that we place so much faith in, they've interviewed sometimes just a few hundred people, maybe a few thousand people to try to extrapolate across a huge spectrum of, you know, demographics and types of people. And they say they have all these scientific methods to adjust the samples. But what if you could use instead a real sample that is millions and perhaps billions of pieces of data from online? If artificial intelligence could sort through in a way that keeps out a lot of the bias that's introduced the way we choose samples now and come up with some really good polling that is more accurate. And that's the idea. Again, we'll talk to someone who's on the fore of this and works with artificial intelligence and the internet as a sample, and she'll tell us about that.
Those stories tomorrow morning, ABC 7 at 10 o'clock, Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. Cheryl, thank you so much.
Thank you.
7:25 now on the Saturday Morning Update. We've got 7:30 news coming up with Heather Curtis, then back with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.
News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. Maryland's Republican gubernatorial candidate Dan Cox says he hopes local jurisdictions will follow state law and start counting mail-in ballots after Election Day, even though two courts ruled they could start this month. The state's highest court yesterday upheld a lower court's ruling allowing election officials to start counting this month to avoid a delay in results. The popularity of mail-in ballots led Montgomery County to not finish counting its ballots from primary day until weeks after the primary. Cox says he disagrees with the court's decision yesterday. A man charged with stuffing the body of his brother's girlfriend in a garbage can and wheeling it to the end of the driveway after she was killed is back behind bars this morning. 25-year-old Stone Colburn was arrested late last night by police in Chatham County, Georgia. The Loudoun County Sheriff's Office says it released Colburn from jail on Thursday after an original murder charge against him was dropped. Commonwealth's attorney Buddha Bibberai says the sheriff's department should not have released him because her office was filing a charge of disposing of a body against him that same day. She says the sheriff's office put out a press release that mischaracterizes the release and tries to unfairly shift the blame to her office. New York City Mayor Eric Adams sends out a call for help as he declares a state of emergency over the arrival of thousands of illegal migrants bused to his city from Texas.
New Yorkers are angry. I am angry too. We have not asked for this. There was never any agreement to take on the job of supporting thousands of asylum seekers.
He says the city's shelters are overwhelmed and it's a humanitarian crisis. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. This week, Montgomery County Council President Gabe Albernoz shared the grim statistics.
According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, intimate partner violence accounts for 15% of all violent crime in the United States.
He says nearly 10 million people are physically abused by intimate partners each year in the U.S. Traffic and weather next on WMAL. Here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In D.C., on the Anacostia Freeway southbound, it's jammed up between Eastern Avenue and Polk Street. Heads up on 395 southbound at the 14th Street Bridge. I'm getting a report of a crash there. No delays on 695. In Virginia, on the Beltway, inner loop and outer loop is at speed. On 66 in Fairfax County, no delays from crashes or construction eastbound or westbound. And on 95 in Virginia, you're now tapping the brakes between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, north and south. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Brisk start to the morning and through the afternoon. Sunshine will help take temperatures up a bit, but still below average in the low 60s. Overnight, 40s and 30s. Some frost once again a possibility off to the west. Mid-60s for highs on Sunday. Early next week, temperatures making a run at near 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraff in the First Alert Weather Center.
Right now, 49 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the host of the Thought to Action podcast, president of the London Center for Policy Research. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to be here.
Report out of Crimea this morning that the Kerch Bridge, which runs between Crimea and mainland Russia, has been partially destroyed, an apparent Ukrainian strike. It was an explosion on the rail section of the bridge. It was reported early this morning. No casualties immediately reported, but there was a major explosion and caused a fire of oil tank cars going on the bridge, according to these reports. And this was a pet project of Vladimir Putin when he took over Crimea back in 2014. So it's a humiliating blow being dealt to him, as reported by CNN this morning. What do you think this means in the next steps that Russia takes against Ukraine?
Well, this was clearly both symbolic and tactically effective as a target because of the strategic importance of that bridge. That's the only bridge, and obviously those train cars being hit and the location where it actually caused damage to the bridge, this is no small thing. So this effectively isolates and limits transportation of needed resources in and out of Crimea. So it's an important strike. And it just goes to expand the idea that Ukraine is being very effective in its offensive going back against the Russians. And I think it's even, I think, incidental to Vladimir Putin's birthday, so that has to be taken into account as well. And it's very clear that the Russians are being pushed harder and harder. This is one more element of demonstration that demonstrates clearly that the Ukrainians are winning. And this is going to require Putin to probably speed up his recall of soldiers and to double or triple down trying to organize around getting his forces into the region to stop the bleeding that the Ukrainian military is causing in all the regions of where they're pushing back.
Now, there have been reports also that the Russian troops have been on the run in the southern areas of Ukraine and that Ukraine recapturing territory there. Do you think things are really changing in a more favorable direction for Ukraine? We've talked about it before, that you've kind of felt that in the long run.
I've never diminished the ability of the Ukrainians to mount and sustain offensive operations to regain territory. What I've said, and I still feel, is the onslaught of 300,000 more troops from Russia is not, you can't stop that. And Putin has already clearly threatened nuclear weapons, and this has been something in the news that has been of great world interest. I was just on British TV this morning at 1 a.m. our time talking about this. So the nuclear issue is something that people are really paying attention to. So that's what I'm saying, Rick. It's like, yeah. All things being equal, the Ukrainians at this point would probably be able to push them out, but things are not equal because there's nuclear weapons and there's additional forces on the horizon. So anything that's done here is going to have to be measured and balanced off of other international issues. And Joe Biden, using the bellicose language that he did a couple days ago in the fundraiser with the Murdochs in New York, seems to have really ratcheted things up. And my concern is, as I said this morning on British TV, is that there's no off-ramp here. Both sides are determined to continue to fight, and I get that. But in any other time that we've been involved as the United States, we've always tried to offer the Russians an off-ramp, a way of, you know, during the Cold War, during the Reagan administration, there was always an option for a negotiated peace. Here, I just don't see that at this point. Both sides seem determined to continue to expand the war if necessary. And I think that's what a lot of people are feeling right now, is the potential spread of this outside the current conflict area.
So Putin has been rattling the saber. And with that strike on the bridge this morning, how big of a poke of the bear is that?
It's huge. And again, I think you're going to see a response from the bear. And that's what I'm worried about. You're going to prompt more and more reactions from Russia, from Putin. To what end? Biden keeps talking about massive retaliation if a nuclear weapon is used. I don't buy it. It's not within our doctrine or policy to respond to a nuclear strike in a non-NATO nation. So Petraeus and these other folks getting out there, they're clearly being given talking points from the White House. But it's not something that can simply be A plus B equals C. It doesn't work like that. So poking the bear without a plan of how to walk the bear down off the precipice of global annihilation is not a good idea. And I just don't think we're there. We have to be much more careful in the language that's used during the Cold War, during the 62 Cuban Missile Crisis, during the other tension periods like the 80s, Rick, language was always critical, so there was no miscalculation, and people were essentially given a path to kind of walk off the basic direction of going to nuclear war. And I think this is one of those things, again, we cannot take too lightly.
Do you get a sense that there is back channel talk with Russia at this point, with us?
No. I don't. And this has been coming up in a lot of the discussions I've had with my team behind the scenes. There's a sense of barreling towards the expansion of the war by the folks on our side. It seems to be that they want an expansion. And a lot of the things you see, and again, I'm not saying this in a bad way. The United States has been very clearly behind supporting Ukraine, and this has become a proxy war. And we're not the only ones that see this. So if you're trying to push the proxy war and you're not pushing diplomacy, then you're probably going to get that expanded war.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, check out the Thought to Action podcast at londoncenter.org. Tony, thank you as always.
Yeah, thank you.
Our pleasure. 7:44, Saturday morning update on WMAL. We'll talk to KT McFarland coming up next, but first, Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Maryland on the Beltway, I looked at the cameras in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County. No crashes or construction slowing you down on the inner loop or on the outer loop. Staying in Montgomery County, on 270 between the Beltway and Frederick, no reports of any delays northbound or southbound. Now in Prince George's County, if you're traveling between the two Beltways on the BW Parkway or 95, lanes are clear there. And on Route 50 in Prince George's County, between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, no delays on the eastbound side or on the westbound side. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Brisk start to the morning and into the afternoon. Sunshine will help take temperatures up a bit, but still below average in the low 60s. Overnight 40s and 30s. Some frost once again a possibility off to the west. Mid-60s for highs on Sunday. Early next week, temperatures making a run at near 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraaff in the First Alert Weather Center.
48 degrees in the nation's capital, 7:45 on the Saturday morning update. 7:49, it's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by KT McFarland, President Trump's first Deputy National Security Advisor. She is a board member of the American Conservative Union, authored the bestseller Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. And we are always honored to have KT join us on Saturday morning. KT, great to have you with us.
Always an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
Explosion this morning on that bridge between Russia and Crimea. We were just talking in detail with Tony Schaefer about that incident and what it might mean for Vladimir Putin moving forward. And as you look at his kind of current status, what's your assessment of his current situation and then what you might see as his next moves?
Well, he knows he can't survive if he goes home an unconditional surrender. And it will make him increasingly desperate. And he's got a long way he could do to escalate in Ukraine. For example, he could start bombing, deliberately bombing schools, hospitals, do to Ukraine what he did to Chechnya in 15 and 20 years ago, just bomb them to just level the entire country and kill just about everybody in it. So he could go that way. He could also escalate, as he's talked about and as President Biden seems to casually talk about, escalate to nuclear weapons. He could also do things like cut the undersea cables, communications cables, that are lying right next to the Nord Stream 1 and 2 undersea cables that the Russians presumably sabotaged about 2 weeks ago. And cutting the fiber optic cables means he cuts off all the communications in Europe. So there are other things he can do, but what worries me is that we're kind of very casually slip-sliding into some kind of larger war in Europe. And part of it is, of course, prompted by the increasingly partisan propaganda media, where on one hand, if you talk about maybe we should find some kind of a negotiated solution to this, where Ukraine gets something, Russia gets something, well, you're labeled a Putin apologist. And yet, on the other hand, if people who want to resupply Ukraine and maybe increase, and maybe even get American forces or NATO forces involved, well, there you're a warmonger. So where there's a lot of unhappy and unfortunate and irresponsible sort of name-calling in the middle of it, and that I find terribly frightening, President Biden's just sort of casually throwing it out at a cocktail party of, oh, we're like on the brink of nuclear war. I think we all need to take one huge step back and try to think about this not just in today's terms, but in the longer range terms. Now, Putin is increasingly desperate. Well, why? He needs money to pay for his new troops. He has to resupply his weapons. He's got to pay for that. Oil prices were falling up until just about a week or so ago, but then with the Nord Stream 2 sabotage, prices have gone up again. Well, why is that important to Vladimir Putin? Because higher oil prices means he gets oil, he gets revenue. He needs the money to pay for this war. He also has to figure out how to drum up support for domestic support for an increasing unpopular war at home. So he's blaming the U.S. for the Nord Stream sabotage. He's annexing provinces in Ukraine to say to the Russian people, look, we're getting something for this. I expect more false flags, more actions on his part. He wants to and needs to blame the U.S. and NATO for invading Russia. Crazy as that sounds to us. He's got to play it to his own people that Russia's being invaded. So in a weird way, Putin wants to escalate this war. He's looking for a response on the part to increase the war, because what he can do is that he can go to the Russian people. The Russian people will put up with a lot, but when they really put up with a lot is when they're invaded. And if you look at the statement that he made as he annexed those provinces, he kept harkening back to, you know, we, Russia, we will always defend the motherland, we'll always defend the homeland, whether it's Napoleon who's invaded or Hitler's invaded or now America that's invaded, we will always defend the homeland and we will always win.
He has a good relationship with OPEC, with China, with North Korea. He's getting closer to Kim Jong-un, North Korea. So he's got outlets for his oil sales. How do we counter that? What do you see in terms of the American energy scenario versus the Russian energy scenario?
You know, the answer to all of our problems is really simple, and that's to restart the American oil and natural gas industry. And why does that make a big difference? Not only is it great because it'll make us energy independent and it'll solve our inflation problems and it'll revitalize the American economy, but if we become energy dominant, that's a different concept. And that means we, the United States, can set the price of oil and natural gas, and we set it very low. Why does that work? Because American companies are owned privately, right? The oil and natural gas companies. And our engineers and scientists and extractors of energy from the earth, they figured out how to get oil and gas from rocks, from shale rocks. And they figured out that we have the best rocks in the world for these purposes, and we could do it more cheaply than anybody else. So we could become the energy source for the whole world with oil and natural gas at quite a low price, if President Biden would only let us do that. And what that will do, it's not only good for us, as I've said, but it'll be terrifically horrible for our adversaries, because they all, Russia, Iran, others, they all need oil and natural gas prices at about $80 a barrel and higher if they're going to pay for all the other things they're doing. Ours only needs to be at $60 a barrel for our companies to make a profit. And if you look at throughout Russian history, every time oil prices have been high and natural gas prices high, the Russians do three things. They rebuild their military, they have proxy wars around the world, and they invade their neighbors. And when energy prices are low, as they were in the late 1980s, Russia hunkers down at home. I mean, it caused the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so why are we giving up this opportunity to drive down energy prices and bankrupt Russia? You know, to play the long game, if there's a way that we can get, now that Ukraine is in fact seizing the initiative, now is a good time to negotiate on Ukraine's terms so they get what they want. Because the minute the fighting stops, what's going to happen 5 years after the fighting stops, within 5 years? The world will rush to rebuild Ukraine. Ukraine within 5 years will have the most, will be completely integrated into the European and Western economy, probably into Western security. Meanwhile, 5 years after the fighting stops, what's happened to Russia? They're broke because of energy prices being low. They're an international pariah because of the way Putin has invaded his neighbors and conducted himself. And they won't be able to launch any more wars against Ukraine or anybody else. And yet the Biden administration just seems fixated on not having American energy be unleashed. He'd rather go have dictators provide our energy. And the argument that, oh, well, we can't have American energy because that's bad for the environment, think this one through a little bit. We do not have the infrastructure right now to go to completely renewables. What we do have the infrastructure to do is have a bridge technology, a bridge energy source. and that would be natural gas. Let clean, cheap, abundant, safe American natural gas not only solve our energy needs, but the world's energy needs.
K.T. McFarland, author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. K.T., as always, thank you so much for the perspectives.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure.
And that's it for the Saturday morning update. Thank you for being with us on this part of the morning. We've got Garden Sense following the 8 o'clock news. Stay with us.